This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Take a walk down Fifth Avenue in New York. You're going to pass some of the biggest and most expensive retailers in the world. Go over a block, saunter down Sixth Avenue, skyscrapers named for Bank of America and Exxon, all symbols of our modern tech-heavy economy. But in between those two thoroughfares of commerce lies a world that might well have existed in the Middle Ages. This is the home of the diamond industry, the middlemen who buy rough gems and polish them up for sale by the jewelry giants. And going here is like stepping into another world. Family dynasties dominate and ethnic networks do what the state cannot. Barack Richman is a professor of law and business administration at Duke University, and he wanted to know why the diamond industry operates in the seemingly ancient way that it does and what it tells us about the rest of our modern economy. He authored the new book, Stateless Commerce, The Diamond Network and the Persistence of Relational Exchange, and he joins me right now. Barack, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about the question that got you going on this project.
You know, your lead-in was perfect. It was the proverbial question of seeing something that's unusual and doesn't quite square with the way we're supposed to understand the world.
And so tell us about what it is that was unusual and what you saw in the diamond industry. Because if I think of diamonds, in capitalism, I think, well, there you go. Big money industry, lots of money changing hands. That's perfect.
Yeah. And the laws of economics suggest that everything is subject to the same kind of economizing forces. So when something is different, it's not just a creation of history or some sort of artifact. There has to be something that actually explains the way it is right now, independent of how it was in the past. So from that basic curiosity, why is this so different? Why is it that it challenges the conventional wisdom that we need courts and large banks and large sources of capital? Why do we need the modern economic institutions that have created wealth? Why is it that all of those are absent from the diamond industry? That's the basic question.
Well, tell us how it's different then in those ways.
So the fundamental insight simply is that a lot of those modern institutions simply do not work for the diamond industry. We think of all of prevailing theory suggests that one of the building blocks, one of the core building blocks of the modern economy is the ability to have contract rights and property rights enforced by the state, by a neutral arbiter of the court. You're able to attract investment. You're able to market your goods widely. And you know that any sort of investment you make that's backed by a property right or a contract right is going to be supported by the state. For diamonds, that simply does not work.
No contracts or few.
Well, there are oral contracts, and sometimes there are written contracts. But the key is not the absence of contracts. The key is that whatever sort of agreements they make, courts can't enforce. I give you diamonds today. You promise to pay me in 30 days. You're gone. Courts can't do anything about that. For cars, for houses, for other sorts of commercial instruments on Wall Street, all of the things are traceable. They're all enforceable. Diamonds are gone. So therefore, what you see here really is a market limitation of modern courts and modern instruments of commerce.
So then how does it operate when it would be so easy to rip people off because they're not supported by state-sanctioned contracts?
Right, exactly. So the first question is, why is it different? And I think the answer is because the normal instruments that the rest of the economy relies on don't work. So the second question is exactly that one. Well, if courts and contracts aren't enforced in a normal way, how do they establish credit sales? How do they navigate a distribution chain that really relies on promises to be kept? And the answer to that proverbially is trust. And if you look at the popular literature, there are a lot of fictional accounts and anthropological accounts of the diamond industry. The word trust is what you normally see. Right. We've done business forever. We live next to each other. Therefore, we can trust each other. But trust is not really an economic term, or at least it describes an economic equilibrium that really asks more questions than it answers. So the economist says, all right, so they say trust each other. How is that trust credible? And your lead-in is exactly the answer. You have family networks, you have religious networks, you have ethnic networks, and these are connections that bind individuals to each other in a long-term process. It's not just that I know you, and it's not just that I can find you in our church or synagogue. This is mostly synagogues and mosques, as it turns out. But it's that I know that if I cooperate with you today, you and I are going to have a fruitful economic relationship in the long term. And the prospects of those long-term benefits is going to compel me to cooperate with you now.
But that used to describe, that is the pre-capitalist economy
exactly.
All over the world. And, you know, capitalism figured out a way to attract anonymous investment, which meant that the investment could go on perpetually, and this is brand new for the world and humans, but it meant that we're going to have these contracts so that I can put on my prospectus, I guarantee to a certain extent a return on your investment. Why wasn't the diamond industry brought into the same thing? Why weren't those social, family, and ethnic networks collapsed in this by the same wrecking ball that
right.
is capitalism,
So, that's exactly the right question. You see two different ways to organize an economy. One is what you see on 47th Street in the diamond industry. And as you described, it is a window into a pre-modern time. Mm. That is how commercial networks formed and enforced and secured themselves before there were modern states and modern courts that was able to enforce what's called impersonal exchange. So we see in 47th Street a window into the past, and we see everywhere else the present. So one question is, as you describe, why is it that 47th Street didn't change? And I think the answer to that is more obvious. That is, the instruments of commercial exchange really don't work here. You cannot enforce diamond sales. You cannot enforce credit sales the same way you can enforce auto sales or sales of houses. But then the reciprocal question...
Well, I'm going to stop you right there, because why not? You've got a commodity. You've got a thing. It's a diamond. I mean, it's a diamond in the rough, and I understand it's going to undergo a transformation. That may be the answer. But why not? I've got X. I can describe X. Certainly, we could figure out a way to mark this commodity so that I can track it through the system and therefore make it ripe for investment in a more traditional, in a more sort of capitalist
form. Yeah. So now the reason... When you make investments, the reason investments in the modern economy are so secure, the reason I know I can invest in an S&P index fund or I can invest in a friend's business is because, or even someone, a business that who's owned by someone I don't even know,
right.
Is because the modern economy has developed instruments. Most of them are basically just contracts. Some of them are secured by other sorts of regulation, other sorts of law, other instruments of the government, where the promises made to me are credible, are enforceable. I have a piece of paper saying that I own a certain number of shares of S&P stock, and I can go to a bank, and I can trade that. People know that what I have on my piece of paper is valuable. But to secure credit for diamond transactions, and we're not talking about a storefront like Tiffany's, and we're not talking about a mining operation that we see sponsored by the De Beers Syndicate in Africa. We're talking about one person who has a handful of diamonds that they have in their pockets that they're looking for good. They're looking to sell. They're trying to polish, and they're trying to find a good jewelry manufacturer who will convert those stones into a commercial product. Those diamonds are not securable by any sort of instrument. And therefore, even though some kind of capital really is required for these diamond tares, these diamond intermediaries to run a business, they cannot go to a bank and say, hey, I've got a really good business plan. Will you please lend me the money? Because the bank will not be able to secure anything. They can only go to family members. They can go to some community members. They can go to people where their promise is secured by the prospect of long-term cooperation. This, at its core, are the building blocks of cooperation.
And it works, and it works extremely well. And so let's be clear about this. This is the part of the supply chain sort of after it's mined and before it's retailed.
Exactly.
So we're talking literally diamonds in the rough here.
Exactly. Yeah. The only real assets are the diamond gems themselves.
Yeah. I still figure there's got to be a way for Wall Street to put a UPC code on each one of those. But anyway, we won't talk about that. Let's talk about these families. Who are these networks? How far back do they go? And how did they get started in the first place?
Yeah, and I just want to embrace that first question. That's always the question to ask. What is the alternative? Why is it that all of the geniuses on Wall Street have not been able to break into this otherwise lucrative industry? They've been trying, and their failure
God, yes.
has been really interesting and revealing. So, who are these people? They are basically two categories of people are involved in the diamond industry. It's basically what's called the families and communities networks. You have families that were brought into the industry by their parents, mostly their fathers. This is a mostly male-dominated industry, although it's changing in a very interesting way. It has been changing over the last, say, 20 years in a very, very interesting way. Mostly a father-to-son or uncle-to-nephew kind of business. The nephew is brought in on the assurance, the integrity, the reputation of the uncle, and the nephew inherits that reputation. And therefore, not only can the nephew enter the industry unlike anybody else who does not have some kind of family connection, but also the nephew is encouraged and induced to cooperate throughout his business life so he can bequeath a reputation. So these are most the staples of this industry are family networks. And the nice thing about family is that no matter where they are in the world, no matter what position they play in a global distribution system, you always know where they are and you always can find them and you can always trust them.
Well, and you really know their tendencies. It's not like they've got some HR dossier that sort of generically defines them. But you know exactly, you know, when this guy is likely to duck into a bar and that's why he's 20 minutes late. Don't worry. That kind of thing helps. You talk about describe a number of these networks, but in India in particular, I was interested because there was some sort of a modernization, the realization that we can do this more cheaply using factory methods, and there was some modernization.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So you think about a world that's primarily dominated by a core set of families, and most of these families are Jewish, at least in America and in the European experience. Because they are an intimate set of Jewish families, they have been able to bring in other community members, non-family community members that they can also trust. So you see in 47th Street, up until really about 1990, it's almost exclusively Jewish and a traditional form of Judaism. Then in the mid-80s and early 90s, you had some Indian families that were able to replicate exactly the family and ethnic structures that were prevailing in the Jewish communities that use the diamond industry. This originated with a very small and interesting community in Gujarat, which is about a six-hour train ride north of Mumbai. The Jains of Palanpur. Palanpur is a small town. Jainism is an offshoot of Buddhism. It's its own religious sect. It's its own geographic sect.
Offshoot of Hinduism?
An offshoot of Hinduism. I'm sorry. Yeah.
No, go ahead.
Actually, I don't think it's offshoot. Well, you know, it's Jainism. It's its own religious sect.
Yeah, there you go.
And they were able to tap into some endemic familiarity with the diamond industry and tapped into sources of rough. And they were able to create these family networks that spread throughout the world. And they really have transformed the whole diamond industry because not only have they provided a real competitive an injection of competition to the prevailing Jewish families, but they were able to build enormous cutting factories in Gujarat, where, of course, the cost of labor is a lot cheaper than in Antwerp and in New York.
So there is some modernization, but again, using the very old techniques,
exactly,
of family networks, which were pre-existing, no doubt.
And I'd be hesitant to call it modernization. It's certainly a hallmark of globalization.
Okay.
But it really is the same distribution chain.
No, and it goes back, I mean, to follow up on that example, the families that are the network of individuals who then actually deliver these things on trains. I mean, maybe you can describe that working for $50 a month.
That's fascinating. So, again, you have the same transactional challenge every step of the way on the distribution chain. Whenever somebody has a diamond that they don't own, that is a threat of flight. And somehow or another, if you're going to have an effective and reliable distribution system, you've got to make sure that every single person who is in possession of your stone, you can account for them. Either they've got to be inside your building and you've got to watch them carefully, or you've got to be able to have some way that they are able to, some way to trust them, and colloquially speaking. A fascinating element of this distribution chain are the Angadiyas in India. And these are people who basically transport diamonds. They are the UPS for diamonds. And they are of an affordable form of UPS. They take the diamonds from Mumbai to Gujarat, where they're polished and then brought back to Mumbai. And they, the reason you can trust them is because they have their own set of ethnic networks and ethnic relationships. It's a fascinating,
but unarmed, you know,
exactly.
They're in a third class car and they're making $50 a month.
They're making $50 a month, and they have, you know, between 10 of them and 15 of them, they have $1 million worth of diamonds.
So what's fascinating about this is that these cooperative, because again, it's based on trust, which to a lot of people might sound crazy. Here's what's crazy: the derivatives on Wall Street that crashed us in 2008, absolutely untrue, fictional, abstract things that couldn't possibly exist and couldn't possibly work, and everybody believed in them, and therefore, until they crashed the whole system, they were working, right? And here's a system that's worked for millennia to some extent. The thing that it can't do is generate the gobs of capital that keep circulating, but it does, I mean, these kind of family networks, again, because there's sort of a cap on anonymous investment. But the world would keep working, would it not? We could transport and transmit and produce products that we need and even want through these networks that we've lost.
Well, you know, in that sense, I think there's probably more of a similarity between the diamond industry and Wall Street than you're describing. And this is taking place right now. At its base, when people make investments, they're making investments that are predicated on certain assumptions. And in the diamond industry, trust has been the prevailing assumption for really at least a millennia. The kind of economic organization you see now is at least a millennia old. But recently, you have seen distrust, or you've seen cheating. And this, in some sense, really is not so dissimilar from an economic bubble in Wall Street. People are making assumptions that something has a certain value, whether it's a relationship or a distribution mechanism. And when there's cheating that takes place, that undermines those assumptions. And tragically, I think, and revealingly, you've seen an increase in distrust, an increase in cheating in the diamond industry over the last decade.
But I guess what I'm saying is that has to have happened many times over the millennia that you described, where somebody broke their contract and broke the trust and lost it perhaps in the family forever. But it could never be UPS in the same way that it could be traded on Wall Street.
Well, that's true. But you know, we're not thinking about individual decisions. We're thinking about aggregate decisions, an aggregate sense of trust. People have there's always been cheaters, and there've always just been people who have made mistakes. You know, I wish I could pay you back. I intended to pay you back, but I made a miscalculation, I can't pay you back. The diamond industry has always had mechanisms to punish those sorts of people, just like if you breach a contract now, you have to pay for damages. The court makes you pay for damages. What's happening now, though, is that, first of all, it is quite remarkable that for about a millennia, you have had this stable equilibrium of trust. These sorts of relationships really have proved to be enormously durable. But they are breaking down now in a more systemic way, not just in an individual way. And there are a lot of reasons why. The final chapter in the book explains the multiple sources. But I think the key insight is this. Ultimately, trust, the foundation of trust, is in many ways just as vulnerable as a foundation supported by the state. It also is subject to bubbles, to speculation, and to a painful adaptation to new circumstances.
Right. And in both cases, they're fictions that you have to believe in.
In both cases.
The inherent honesty of this individual or something called the state, which if we stop believing in it, would go away.
They both rely on certain institutionally supported sources of predictability and certainty. And when things change, it's a painful adjustment.
Barak, I'm glad you asked this question. It's a fascinating subject and so good to have you on the program. Barak Richmond, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Professor of Law and Business Administration at Duke University, author of Stateless Commerce, The Diamond Network and the Persistence of Relational Exchange. We've got information at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, a new book, Lord of Monsters, that takes us into an alternate universe for young readers. Stay with us on The State of Things.